This audio interview with Len Oliver was recorded on 21st September 2018 in Cowra by Nikkei Australia's Mayu Kanamori and Masako Fukui. This interview was recorded for the Cowra Voices geolocative storytelling app, created in 2019 and launched to coincide with the 75th anniversary of the Cowra breakout. For more information, please refer to the overview in this archive.
Okay. My name is Len Oliver. I'm a son of Albert Oliver, who was a local man, born and bred locally here in Cowra. He was part of a big farming family. He had eight brothers and one sister. And he was born in 1918 and lived through that period of time where there was a lot of a lot of hard work to be done after the First World War. They lived through the Depression, and then of course the Second World War came along, and my father and some of his brothers enlisted in the Australian Army to go overseas and be a part of the army and whatever they had to do in various odd theatres of war. But he was in the 2nd 17th Battalion 9th Division, which went over to North Africa, and they fought against the Italians and Germans over there. He was in the battles of Tobruk and El Alamein, and he was promoted in the field to warrant officer second class, and they became known as the Rats of Tobruk over in North Africa. After about 3 years, they returned to Australia. They trained for a period of time, and after some jungle warfare training, they were then sent up to New Guinea initially and fought in various odd battles there at Lae and Finchhaven, and over to Borneo, and the war actually finished when they were in Borneo. So he then returned home, and there was a period of rehabilitation, and before he came back to Cowra. He then went in a partnership with another ex-serviceman in a business, a farm supply business and stock and station agency. And that developed into a very, very successful business over many years. The business was eventually sold, I think, in the my brother bought most of it. And so when they returned back then, you had quite a few young men who had served in the armed forces, and they returned home and went back to doing what they could do as normally as possible. But my father joined the committee of the Returned Services League, the RSL as it's known, and over a period of years, a few of them got together and decided they'd have working bees up in the up in the Japanese War Cemetery and the Australian War Cemetery, just to keep the place tidy and to mow the lawns and you know, kill the weeds, etc., and just to look after it. It was purely and simply, I think, that most of them, because most of them had lost friends in North Africa, so they had some friends that were buried over in various odd parts of the Western Desert and certainly in New Guinea and Borneo. And they were hoping that someone would look after their friends. So they thought it was what should be done here to look after the bodies of or the graves of the soldiers here, the Japanese soldiers in particular, that died in the breakout, and certainly other people as well that died while they were in internment camps and that sort of thing in Australia. So They sort of started that. The council then, the Carrick Council, then got on board and they started to provide staff to help to maintain these graves, etc. The Australian War Graves Commission got involved and sort of recognised that it, because Cowra had the breakout, it was important that these graves be well maintained because it was, people were, so you've got to remember after the war, like, people didn't know, no one ever knew, all these sorts of things were kept secret. So it was probably well into the late 50s and 60s before even Australians got to know that there'd been a prisoner of war breakout here in Cowra on our own soil. So then it became obvious that that would in itself start to attract tourism and people would be interested and et cetera, et cetera. So it started to sort of grow from there, and I think my father was, I can't remember the first year, he went from the RSL to the council. He was always very community-minded. He was in Rotary for probably 40-odd years and all this sort of business. Very community-minded man. And he went onto the council and became mayor. And I think it was in the, might have been the second time that he was mayor in the 60s. By that time, they were starting to organise the student exchange between Cowra High School and Sakya High School in Japan, and people thought that was a great idea. This was done with, by this time, instead of just a very small group of people that were involved in doing the graves, it now was developing into quite a few more people who were becoming interested and involved in how it would all work. So the student exchange got underway, and then, of course, the Japanese Garden. By that time, we were starting to get the Japanese ambassador would come up from Canberra. We even had the Japanese prince and princess come out and visit Cowra. So when I was in the teens, I think. Yeah, very special. Very special. It was a great event. This is royalty, you know, coming to Cowra sort of thing. So it was, it was very special. I mean, we never had our own royalty come to Cowra, and here were the Japanese royalty people coming, you know, so it was very special. And, of course, they're very, very attractive people. She was, from my memory, she was a beautiful young woman, and he was a good-looking young man. So, and they got along with all the people here, and it was a great event.
What do you remember doing?
It was just, we were kept out of it as kids a little bit sort of thing, but it was all very, very official luncheons and then visits to the cemetery. And
did you see them?
Yes. I didn't meet them.
When you saw them?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. Can you describe it?
Oh, yeah. Just very impressive. I guess in those days I'd always been thinking about, sort of Japanese men and women being the father and mother's age, as you do, type of thing. But these people were younger and they were good-looking people. You know, they were clever. Obviously, it's something all of us Australians admire, I suppose. Most people from Asia can speak two or three languages. We can only ever speak one, you know. So these, you know, the prince and princess, always so gracious, beautiful looking. Yeah, they laid wreaths at all the places, and I think all the women that were there were very all of the Australian women were very impressed by them and how the princess dressed and all that sort of thing. So,
What about you? Do you remember seeing them in a car driving past? What's your memory?
Oh, yes, getting in and out of the cars and that sort of, yes. We followed behind them with quite a few other people. There were quite a few. I don't know how. My impression would have been quite a few hundred people that were involved in just this following them around. You know, it was very special. But since then too, we've had a lot of very, very important Japanese people, certainly politicians, ambassadors, etc., come out. But the prince and princess, that was very special. That was something that I think, because it happened quite a while ago, a lot of people here might remember. It's only my age group now, because I was probably only in my late teens or something, I think.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure, like, where did you see them? Because I think you're the only person that we've spoken to that actually have seen them. It doesn't matter.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Where was the cemetery and the site? The POW campsite at that stage. Yes.
What were you doing there?
We were just being carted around by the people. We were very interested because my father was involved, very much so. And I can't even think now whether our Prime Minister was here or whether it might have been our State Premier was here at the time.
That doesn't matter.
We had a lot of Australian dignitaries here.
We don't care about the dignitaries. No. We want to know about what you were doing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You were, like, 16,
17? Yes, and that sort of age group,
you,
I remember.
You were in a car with your dad?
I think. No.
Okay.
No, he was off with the... with the other dignitaries, so we were sort of left out the back type of thing. We were following the crowd around, and we'd have to try and get to wherever they were going as quickly as we could to get a park somewhere, so that we could race out to where they were and have a look at what they were doing. So, but that was that was very special. That was very special. They had. They had an official luncheon up at the Services Club, actually, so we weren't there. That was closed to all the dignitaries. But yes, it was when they were out in the public, driving around and having a look around town. I think they took them up to the lookout and gave them a bit of a tour around town, and then of course they laid wreaths and that type of thing, which was. Yeah, very special. Very special.
Do you mind if we just go back a bit?
Hmm.
How did your dad tell you about his, you know, the helping with cleaning up the Japanese graves? How did you know about it?
Yeah, well, he didn't, none of these men ever spoke about the war. So we never heard anything. And I, when I was very young, I remember getting on the back of the truck with him and going up there one day, and a few of the other men arrived and they were cleaning up and that sort of thing. So they'd just spend a few hours up there. They'd take their lawnmowers up there. They'd just mow the lawn, cut the weeds, just tidy it up, you know, whatever had to be done to make it look presentable. And they'd get, I remember, one of them turned up one day with a few plants and shrubs that they planted, but they could never work out who was going to have to come up regularly and keep watering them, you know, because there was no underground, there was no irrigation or anything, there was no real water supply. Well, there was up at the town cemetery but you'd have to cut into a pipe there and do it. So all those things happened later, you know. So it was pretty primitive. And like I say, it was really, I think the biggest problem was no one knew anything about this at all until probably well into the 50s. And it became, and then it was the 60s. So this... you know, the breakout was, you know, 1944. I was born in 48, So mid-50s, 60s before it really got a roll on, and people started to really take an interest. And then, of course, the support grew for and it was to make sure then that that whatever could be done to sort of rearrange and renovate those the cemetery. And over a period of years, the POW campsite, there was talk at one stage of reconstructing part of the campsite so that they could make a movie about it. But I think, with great respect to the Japanese, they didn't want that to happen. They sort of regarded that as a bit of, almost like a little bit of sacred land. You know, they preferred not to have the original site used in that type of thing. So that was done. So movies were made, but not here. Mm.
Just if you had any more childhood memories, whether it's at the cemetery or at the field,
yeah. Yeah, but, I think.
Did you help your dad?
Oh, not really. We were there.
Who's we? You and your dad?
This is myself, my brother.
Yeah.
Yes. We were there occasionally. And one of the other boys I can remember, Harry Telfer, he turned up occasionally. He was a friend. He turned up with his dad. But that was pretty rare. The men had often get it organised and go up on a Sunday morning or something like that, and they'd do it, and they'd do it often earlier in the morning, and quite often it was, you know, we weren't sort of really invited to go.
So can you tell me who the men were?
There was Keith Telfer was one, and there was another bloke, Col Stinson, who was another one. They were RSL guys. Col Stinson was a bomber pilot, actually. Keith Telfer was in the tanks. He was in army tanks and that sort of thing during the war. But and then there was a floating population of a few other men. There weren't a lot. Three or four. That grew a little bit then, over a period of time, as other guys found out it was happening, and they then offered to help. You know, that type of thing. So that sort of grew a little bit. But then I think I have the feeling that it sort of got going fairly quickly. Once the council decided to take it over and organise periodically council staff and council equipment to go up there, well, then I think water was connected. And then, of course, over a period of years, the actual layout was changed slowly but surely to what it is now, so that it was trees and shrubs and flowers and that sort of thing, so, and the rocks. So that happened over a period of, probably 20 or 30 years. It didn't happen quickly. It didn't happen quickly, but it was... But then it was, the Japanese gardens, and that was the whole thing exploded then, because suddenly we started to get a huge amount of interest from Japanese business people, and the big one that I'll always remember was Nagakura. He was Kyushu Electric Power Company. And he and his son, but the father, was a brilliant man, just so generous, so gentle. I'd hate to think of how much money they've donated to it, that particular company. Now, there were quite a few other companies as well that over the years have contributed, very substantial amounts of money to the Japanese gardens and Nagakura Park, of course, which is in his name.
Do you have any memories of Saburo Nagakura?
I met him twice, because in the early 80s I'd finished playing rugby union and I was coaching. So I'd played twice against Japanese teams. One was Kyushu that had come out here to Kara. So I'd played twice against them. But we were then invited to go to Japan. So over a two-year period, we organised a tour to Japan. And I was actually coaching that tour. So I'd met him once here, probably. I'd seen him three or four times, but I'd met him once here. Then met him again, of course, over in Japan, and that was terrific. So they were tremendous memories, but very, very, very gracious, very generous people. Yeah, outstanding. It's so that connection has sort of it just once that once the Japanese Garden's got going, the whole concept of this relationship with Japan just absolutely boomed. It was extraordinary.
Did you like him, Mr. Nagakura?
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, see, I was I'd become a little bit familiar because I was the Toyota dealer here for 38 years, so I and that was from 1970 on. So I got to meet a lot of Japanese men. And in 1970, a lot of the Japanese executives that were running the business in Australia here for Toyota, they were men in their 50s and 60s, quite a few of them. So I always found a lot of the older men to be very courteous, very gracious, very generous, and always very helpful, you know. So they were nice people. I like the young Japanese men too, but they were getting too westernised in those days. They became a little bit too smart, too clever, you know. A bit like our people, our young men, you know. But anyway, it was great. So I was very fortunate to have this connection in my hometown, where I was born and where I'd lived, or where I live, and then, of course, a continuance of that through business. But, Nagakura in particular, he stood out. Some of the other men I had met from other companies, but I can't remember their names, really. It was sort of I was there with a group of people and just shook their hand and said hello, and then it was sort of they passed on, you know, as it happens, because a lot of these visits are sort of quite busy and everything happens very quickly. But in the early days, the important part again, and I come back to this, the early days, I think it was great that these early returned servicemen started to just do this simple task, which really started the whole thing. It was...
How do you feel about it? Do you feel proud of your dad? Or...
Oh, yeah, very proud, yeah.
Would you mind saying that?
Proud of my dad? Yes, very proud of my father, yes. Yeah, yeah, he was a great man. He was never home. Mum always had to come and watch us play sport and everything, but he was a very busy man. But I think he felt that he was one of those people that had a great desire to contribute to the community, and I think his war experiences taught him, because I think I said it to you the other night on the phone. I'll never forget the one thing he did say, and he said it two or three times over the years, was that he said, "We've got to do everything we possibly can do to make sure this never happens again." Yeah, so it's because it was... see, he never found out until after he'd returned about the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. you know, and I think that really concerned him. He said, "You can't do that to people. You know, that's you just can't do those sorts of things." So it's, you know, yeah.
So how has those sorts of things that your dad said? How has that influenced you? Who you are?
Oh, I think it makes a difference. I think it makes you prepared to sit back and listen, and to be prepared to be more mindful of other people and what their beliefs are and what their culture is and how they live, that type of thing. I've sort of I think it's helped me greatly, actually, because we, after the war, of course, We had an army camp just not far from out on the Derby's Falls Road, actually, and when the war finished, that became a migrant camp. So we had a lot of people from Europe that immigrated to Australia after the war, and to help them assimilate, they put particularly all the families where there were children involved as well. So they put them in the migrant camps out there and taught them English, got them started, and help them learn if the men in particular, if they didn't have a trade, they would train them and that sort of thing, and try and find work. And eventually that worked very well for them. But so we in Cowra here, when I grew up going to school here, we had a lot of the kids from the migrant camp coming in as well. So we, right from a very early age, I was very much exposed to Aboriginal children, Indigenous kids, because we all went to school together. And of course, the people from the migrant camp, a lot of those young people were from European, Yugoslavia, all those sorts of, a lot of those different European countries. So, Greeks and Italians as well, of course, etc. But and quite a few of them are still around. Their families have lived in Cowra, and they've now had grandchildren, and probably some of them great grandchildren. But it was a very easy place to learn to recognise think about other cultures and enjoy what those other cultures have to offer. You know, and of course. And over the years, we've all grown to enjoy what Japan has to offer. You know, it's sometimes you look back and you wonder, how in the hell did that happen? You know, but anyway.
How in the hell? What happened?
The war. Yeah.
Can you say
all
that?
Wars. How in the hell did the war happen? You know, it's you really look back at it and you sort of think, well, How did all those things, all those sets of circumstances line up to create a situation where nations, major nations throughout the world, would decide to throw millions of young men into combat against other nations? I mean, you shake your head, really, sort of think, well, you know, there's got to be. We can understand some of the reasons, I suppose, when you dig deep enough. But it's. But at the end of the day, it's it created. I mean, I suppose in the early days too. Some of the Australian soldiers that came back, some of Dad's friends here. And our family friends, some of those men were very badly affected by it. Yeah, some did commit suicide in the late 20s and 30s, and that sort of business, because they just couldn't come back to. Because the worst part about what they all did was that they were away from here for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And it was non-stop, you know. It's not like nowadays. I have I have a son-in-law that's just retired from the SAS, and he's over in Perth. And but they do rotations of 6 months and fly home. And of course, some of his friends have died in combat, but they've flown their bodies home. Well, you know, that never happened. It was just outright slaughter, wasn't it? When you think about it, back in the Second World War and First World War. So the reconciliation process, I think, from our point of view, has been very significant, and it's been of really a huge benefit to Australia as well economically. I think Australia was one of the first countries after the Second World War to recognise that that somehow or other you had to push that aside and make an effort to reconcile with people so that you could get on with your lives and you could then trade. And of course, after the war, as you know, with the American help of money, etc., the Japanese economy, once it got moving, absolutely boomed through the 50s and 60s and 70s. And suddenly Japan became a major trading partner of Australia. And I think a lot of what happened was those relationships by ambassadors and how they were treated and this sort of thing, I think it helped probably to ease the tension as such. My story is a good story. It's a happy story, yeah, because I was born. I didn't realise really what had happened. I was born here, went to school here, and it was only suddenly by sort of getting to understand and listen and hear what the adults were saying that you sort of started to realise what had gone on. So it was, being part of watching it happen. And I think my father was very, very proud that he made it, all of the exchange students, the Japanese that came over, they always came to our place in the early days and had a meal with us and that sort of business. And Dad always looked after them, you know. He'd always...
Tell us about the meals. Are you always to be there?
Well, yeah. Part of the time, yes, yeah. Part of the time. I went to school in Sydney for the latter part of my education and then I was working. So I left school in 65. 1965. So the exchange student program hadn't been going for that long.
Do you remember any students?
Oh, Keiji was one. And a couple of the girls. Always find it hard to remember the girls' names.
Doesn't matter that the names were
there. Yeah.
Were they nice?
Funny. Oh, yeah, all of them, yeah. I think that, once again, I think the Japanese were very, very selective. The Japanese students we got here, I think, were very, very clever young people and very personable, very friendly, and very, very much prepared to do anything and have a crack at anything. And I think Mum always just put a meal on the table that we'd eat. And of course, if the student... if they weren't too sure what it was that they were going to eat, Mum, you know, we'd sort of explain it. And we always sort of said, look, try it. If you don't like it, just push it aside. Find out what you do like, you know. And most of them made an effort to eat almost everything, whether they liked it or not, I think. But some of them, I remember one of the boys sort of saying, oh, so much meat. I've never seen so much meat, you know, because Mum would always do lamb or steaks or something or other, you know. So, yeah, so those sorts of things. But they were very, very, very good people. And I think a lot of the Mum and Dad went to Japan on a few trips. I think Dad paid for his own trip the first time to go over and meet with the headmaster of Seike, I think. And then after that, the exchanges then were terrific. And it's worked so well, and it's continuous now. So, and the host families are very good here, which is great. I was always worried that over a period of time that we'd run out of host families, because Cowra's not a big town, as you know, and it's and particularly now with a lot of the women working as well, because when it first started, quite a few of the host families, the woman was not working full time. She would have children of her own, and that was the reason that they were a host family, so that the Japanese student could stay with them, with at least one student of a very similar age, and sex, of course, you know, the girls were the girls, and that type of thing. So it was all fairly carefully selected. But the host families have been fantastic over the years.
Have you ever had any hosted any
kids? I haven't, no, personally, no. No, no, I...
And your kids obviously grown up, but...
Yes.
You've been handed this legacy from your father. How do you hand it to the next and the generations coming?
Oh, I think to anything like this is fantastic. I think people have got to understand it's a bit like the Jewish Holocaust. People have got to understand that it did happen, and you can't ignore it, and you've got to make sure that it never happens again.
How do we do that?
Oh, I think it's very, very difficult, isn't it? I talk to people. A lot of I encourage. I think I've encouraged people to travel. As often as they can. I've participated in a lot of fundraising efforts to help young people go on sporting trips or whatever. Whatever can be done to get people away from their own small world that we all live in, and if we're not too careful, we become too insulated. Because we're too busy, but luckily Australia is becoming more multicultural. People.
Just before you go on.
Yeah.
So why a little town like Cowra, which most country towns are being insulated? Mm. How did Cowra manage to be so outward looking? Do you think?
Well, I think probably the Japanese connection as well as the migrant camp. So after the Second World War, we really did have people living in our town who weren't Australian born and bred. So we had, and it was quite a few. It was quite a few, actually, from memory. And they were all good people. When I say they're all good people, I mean 99%, you know. There's always the odd one, but it's but we're the same. But it's so I think we were just it. The Japanese connection, I think, has had a huge influence on people that were born and bred in Cowra, and their descendants like me, and of course. Those that come after me, I think it's a realisation that that out of absolute disaster and tragedy, things can improve if people will just sit back and listen and talk and think and accept other people's culture and other people's opinions and other people's attitudes towards things, because I've never found a situation where... Oh, sorry, I tell a lie. I think twice in my life I haven't been able to negotiate out of a situation where I couldn't find some common ground and agreement, apart from on the sporting field. Well, that's, you know... against the opposition, you just want to beat them anyway, but... But it's but with regards to my personal life and business life, I mean, just stop and listen for a minute, and you know, and think about what's being said, and what people are saying. And
thank you. That's beautiful. I think just to end, I might just ask you to do what we asked you to do in the beginning, is to reintroduce yourself and just very quickly say, because your dad was Albert Oliver, but people referred to him as
Ab
Oliver. Mm. So if you could just say that. And I think he was mayor three times?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you could just say, my name is, my dad was Albert Oliver, people call him Ab Oliver, he was a mayor of Cowra three times, whatever.
Three different occasions. Okay. My name is Len Oliver. I am a son of Albert Oliver. Albert was commonly known as Ab Oliver. It was abbreviated when he was a young man, and he was forever known as Ab Oliver. He was a local man, born and bred in Cowra, and in his lifetime spent many years on the Cowra Shire Council and did three terms as mayor, as well as other terms as deputy mayor and councillors. He was held in such high regard by the community generally that we... did not want to ever make it appear that we were using that influence for our own benefit. So it's an Australian thing, I guess, to a certain extent, is that you like to achieve things yourself and not be known as the son of someone else, whatever. So that's a... It's just one of those things, I guess. But both of us felt a little bit like that. My brother's been very successful in business and done a lot of work in town. He's currently president of the golf club and all that sort of thing, and does a lot of work over there. And I've been involved in rugby union and cricket here for many years, done a lot of work there. But we, I suppose to a certain extent, purposely avoided... treading on the same stones as our father, because he was so highly regarded that we just sort of felt that we'll make our own way.
But you think it's important to talk about him now?
Oh yeah, very much so. Very much so, because he's gone, and I think what he and a certain number of other men did, that number then grew fairly quickly over 20-odd years. And it's been quite remarkable. There are people now that have spent a huge amount of time on helping to run the Japanese Gardens or helping to run the exchange student program. They are very, very good people, you know. But there's too many to mention, and if I try to mention, I'll forget some very important people, and of course then people get very offended by it. So, but I just want to make sure that people understand the start, where that first little bit of work was done, that helped to create a situation where, because there wasn't many of them, and they were all returned servicemen.
That's great. Thank you so much. Thank you.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.